headlines this hour. Iran's foreign minister says Tehran and the International Atomic Energy Agency have reached a good agreement to address some of the agency's concerns. Russia slams the European signatories to the JCPOA for their unconstructive approach and opposes any proposals that would go beyond the framework of the accord. And the British Prime Minister comes under further pressure after rebellion within his own party, the opposition Labour leader saying that Boris Johnson is too weak to lead. Hello, welcome. This is Mews. Thanks for joining us. Iran's foreign minister says that Tehran and the International Atomic Energy Agency have reached a good agreement that could ease alleged concerns over the country's peaceful nuclear activities. Hossein Amir Abdollahian said that the agreement can help boost cooperation between Iran and the IAEA, which has occasionally attempted to use its technical capacity to wield political influence on JCPOA revival talks. Amir Abdollahian did not elaborate on the agreement, but the Nur News website, which is close to Iran's Supreme National Security Council, said that Tehran has voluntarily allowed the agency to replace its damaged cameras at the Karaj site. The website said the decision came upon the completion of checks on the affected cameras, as well as the IAEA's step to condemn the act of vandalism against the site. The IAEA had previously asked for access to the Karaj site that came under a sabotage attack in June. Amir Abdollahian also touched on the ongoing talks in Vienna, saying that he is optimistic about progress in negotiations. Moscow says the stances of the European parties to the 2015 deal with Iran in the ongoing Vienna talks are surprising, unconstructive, and somewhat illogical, as if they were sitting at a negotiating table for the first time. Russia's representative to the Vienna-based international organizations, Mikhail Ulyanov, has made the remarks in an interview with Iran's Russian language Parse Today. He believes that the Vienna talks are moving ahead slowly, with high chances of having a positive outcome. The Russian representative said the Iranian delegation is very serious with clear demands. He also praised Iran's draft proposals as a step forward. Ulyanov said that Moscow is opposed to any proposals that would go beyond the framework of the 2015 deal. According to Ulyanov, there are major obstacles to getting a guarantee from the U.S. that it won't withdraw from the deal again. Journalist and political analyst Abbas Aslani says what the Western parties to the 2015 deal want is to give less to Tehran and to get more from it.
Well, it seems the excessive demands by the Europeans as well as the United States in Vienna talks are in a way that even the other parties in the 4+1 are protesting against those demands. They disregard the Iranian concerns when it comes to the benefiting from the lifting of the sanctions. And if that is the case, I think there will be no success in the talks. There needs to be balanced in the demands or the approaches in the negotiations. And the Europeans, as well as the United States, want to put the pressure of time, as well as, the IAEA-related issues on Iranian delegation in order to get more compromises, meaning that they want to give less to Iran but to gain more from the country. And this will not be a balance that can contribute to the restoration of the JCPOA, as well as that will also be detrimental to the durability of the 2015 nuclear agreement.
Opposition Labour Party leader has come down hard on Prime Minister Boris Johnson over his handling of the coronavirus pandemic.
Mr. Speaker, the virus is spreading once again and lives and livelihoods are at risk. The British public are looking for a Prime Minister with the trust and the authority to lead Britain through the crisis. Instead, we're burdened with the worst possible Prime Minister at the worst possible time.
Keir Starmer added that Johnson is too weak to lead. The Premier, however, claimed that he had taken a balanced and proportionate approach toward tackling the pandemic, which was right for the UK. This comes one day after nearly 100 of his own party MPs broke ranks and rebelled against new restrictions over the spread of the Omicron variant. Johnson is also facing back-to-back scandals, which have undermined his own popularity, as well as support for Conservatives. People are angry over a leaked video showing Johnson's top aides talking about a Downing Street Christmas party during last year's COVID lockdowns. prime minister is also under fire over the costly refurbishment of his residence. UK's economy is in trouble. New data is showing that inflation there has reached its highest level in more than 10 years. According to the Office for National Statistics, the annual rate rose to 5.1% in November. The cost of factory products and the price of raw materials also jumped to the highest rate in 12 years. The coronavirus pandemic is taking part of the blame. The global fuel supply crunch and a jump in commodity prices are also pushing up inflation. The Bank of England will announce its latest monetary policy decision on Thursday. Central banks use interest rate hikes to try to damp high inflation. Said Puruza says the Bank of England resisted raising the interest rates in its previous meeting, despite soaring inflation in the country.
For the last time, the pressure came on to the Bank of England to decide on what it was going to do with the interest rate. It resisted. They voted 7-2 to keep the interest rate at the level it was at. It was 0.1%. So what the Bank of England does is it works on the principle of keeping the inflation down. But then if the inflation rate is rising precipitously, which is what it is seemed to be doing right now, the Bank of England increases the inflation rate. What it does that for is it hopes for the increase in the interest rate to lead to people buying less or spending less money, and that sort of sorts out the supply and demand problem, which will in turn push prices down or keep inflation in check.
Russia says it has delivered to the United States its proposals for security guarantees over NATO's eastward expansion. Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov handed the proposals to the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for European and Eurasian Affairs. That after President Vladimir Putin said that he wanted talks to start immediately. Moscow is asking for legal guarantees that the Western military alliance will not use Ukraine as a launching pad. Kremlin has expressed hope that NATO will give a positive evaluation to the demands. Tensions are running high between Moscow and the West over Ukraine. The European Union has just warned of unprecedented measures in case of what it calls further Russian aggression. The U.S. and its allies have recently accused Russia of preparing to invade Ukraine. The Kremlin denies that, saying its military activities are only meant to secure their own borders. Political commentator Greg Simmons says that the EU is only echoing the U.S.'s claims about Russia's military activities near Ukraine.
Well, it's what I'd come to expect. The EU has demonstrated that it's not an independent actor, but a vassal of the United States. And these talks are just echoing what has been coming from Washington. And what we have here, I mean, you have a similar case with the JCPOA against Iran and Taiwan against China. You have these cases. Ukraine has been used against Russia. It's not an established fact that Russia is going to invade. Why would they? There is no incentive for them to do so, let alone with as few troops as they say. This is that they're trying to create and shape and engineer how people see this event. It is not a real one, because this is an attempt to restrict Russia and its ability to project and protect its own interests and foreign policy objectives. And they're trying to tie this, of course, with Nord Stream 2 so that it can damage geoeconomic interests of Russia, but also the EU by creating these sanctions.
The United States hits a grim milestone in its fight against the COVID pandemic, with the number of deaths in the country now passing the 800,000 mark. The data from Johns Hopkins University represents the highest reported toll of any country in the world. Most deaths have been recorded among the unvaccinated and the elderly. The U.S. reached 50 million confirmed cases of COVID-19 two days ago. The alarming surge in deaths comes as the world is bracing for a rise in cases of the new Omicron variant, with the World Health Organization warning that it is spreading at an unprecedented rate.
77 countries have now reported cases of Omicron, and the reality is that Omicron is probably in most countries, even if it hasn't been detected yet. Omicron is spreading at a rate we have not seen with any previous variant.
The WHO chief said many countries are rolling out their booster shots, warning of a repeat of vaccine hoarding and inequity. He noted that there are many people who have not received a single jab yet. Omicron was first detected in November. It has a large number of mutations. A preliminary study by South African scientists suggests that Omicron is highly transmissible and may evade immunity from vaccination. Over 24 more Palestinians become homeless as the Israeli regime forces them to leave their ancestral homes in occupied East Al-Quds. A family of 27 in the Silwan neighborhood has been targeted this time. They were pressed by the regime's officials to leave and demolish their own homes. Many of those left homeless include children and elderly. On Tuesday, Israeli forces bulldozed the remains of a Palestinian home in the same neighborhood. Some of the Palestinians whose homes are subject to demolition raised them by their own hands to avoid further penalty. The Israeli regime regularly flattens Palestinian homes and structures in Al-Quds under the pretext that they lack building permits. Both Palestinians and rights groups say that the moves are aimed at grabbing more Palestinian lands to expand its illegal settlements. The U.S. initially claimed to have targeted Daesh terrorists in Kabul, but the victims turned out to be Afghan civilians, seven kids among them. After an investigation, the Pentagon called it, quote, an honest mistake. But then again, it did nothing to make amends. And that tragic mistake spelled the final chapter in the lives of 10 innocent civilians, adding to the thousands more whose bloods are in U.S. hands.
The U.S. will not punish its military personnel involved in a deadly drone strike in Afghanistan back in August. The strike happened during the final days of U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan and killed 10 civilians, including an aid worker and his entire family members. Seven of the victims were young children. The U.S. military launched the drone strike after a deadly bomb attack near Kabul airport, which killed scores of people, including 13 U.S. military servicemen. Back then, U.S. military officials blamed the bomb attack on Daesh terrorist group. Pentagon claimed a car, which belonged to one of the victims, was linked to Daesh militants. But now U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has decided against disciplining any members of the United States military involved in that attack. An internal Pentagon review concluded last month that the bombing in the Afghan capital did not violate the laws of war and was not caused by misconduct or criminal negligence.
If the secretary believed that in the case of the 29 August airstrike that accountability was warranted and needed, he would certainly support those kinds of efforts.
Well, the Pentagon is obsessed with deflecting any responsibility from its negligence or its miscalculations or its blatant corruption, so they are throwing out a diversion with the full expectation that there'll be no further addresses by the United States, and most likely nothing will be arising out of any international bodies without a severe complaint, perhaps by a joint coalition of countries such as Russia.
The Pentagon admitted in September that the drone strike was a tragic mistake. Washington had previously claimed that those who killed were terrorists. The military initially defended the bombing as a righteous strike, and it insisted that it hit operatives from a group affiliated with Daesh who were planning an imminent attack on Kabul's airport.
And this has brought a very psychotic nature to the military minds. So we're witnessing a military that is largely devoid of any religious or humanitarian impulses or restraints. And we've seen that in many interviews with some U.S. military members, even admitting to their willingness to shoot on their own people in the United States.
And that is for this edition of World News. Thank you.
follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsetodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsetodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
One thing appears reasonably certain. This new wave, in whatever iteration, will likely exercise the peak of its lethality within the ranks of those who believed Trump's tall tales about rounding the turn, says William Rivers Pitts, journalist, in an article published under the heading, "As more info emerges on Omicron, Trump's old COVID lies continue to kill people." Stay tuned for more. On October 27, 2020, then-President Donald Trump stood before a mostly maskless assemblage of adoring fans and declared the nation was rounding the turn on the COVID-19 pandemic. It was the 40th time he had made this claim in the last 57 days, and it was no more true than it is now. The average daily infection rate at that time stood around 85,000 new cases per day. Today, over 121,000 cases a day, with a daily death toll back above 1,200. A lot of Trump's people at that time fully believed his negligently homicidal claims about that corner, and many of them still do. Not as many now, of course. Some have come to embrace the science, but tens of thousands of Trump supporters have been killed by this thing, by Trump's flippant dismal of it all. Because of this, there will in all likelihood never be a corner to turn. Endemic is the hot word among COVID epidemiologists these days, which is science speak for pretty much forever. Since May 2021, people living in counties that voted heavily for Donald Trump during the last presidential election have been nearly three times as likely to die from COVID-19, reports NPR. The trend was robust even when controlling for age, which is the primary demographic risk of COVID-19 mortality. The data also reveal a major contributing factor to the death rate difference. The higher the vote share for Trump, the lower the vaccination rate. Now comes the ominously titled Omicron variant, cousin to the Delta variant that is presently spreading all over the US. Omicron has been confirmed in 66 countries all over the world and in 22 US states. COVID experts are laying themselves out trying to answer a number of pressing questions. How transmissible is Omicron? Are the symptoms worse than Delta? Will the vaccines still work? A sobering portrait of the Omicron variant is emerging from the first burst of lab studies on the coronavirus' latest incarnation, showing that the mutated virus can slip past a shield of protection provided by the standard two-shot vaccine regimen, reports the Washington Post. This is but one of the studies that are taking place, as yet to be peer-reviewed and rigorously confirmed. There are also suggestions that the symptoms of Omicron could be mild in comparison in those of Delta or the original strain. More than 40 people in the U.S. have been found to be infected with Omicron variant so far, reports the Associated Press, and more than three-quarters of them had been vaccinated. The chief of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said recently, but she said nearly all of them were only mildly ill. We can speculate all we wish about the possible need for boosters amid a mild symptom, fifth wave of infections, but we won't have solid data about Omicron until all testing has been completed and reviewed. Even then, the variant's long-term effects will remain unknown. One thing appears reasonably certain, however. This new wave, in whatever iteration, will likely exercise the peak of its lethality within the ranks of those who believe Trump's tall tales about rounding the turn. If Trump had a single care for the people who make him possible, he would embark on a vaccination campaign in all the states he carried in 2020. But he will not do this unless forced to. He will squat in his Bedminster lair plotting revenge, even as those he owes his power to die preventable death every day. It did not have to be this way, but here they are. Perhaps, after another winter of illness, suffering, and doubt, at least some of those who embrace Trump's denial of science will find their way out of that fog.
علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the Charter of Islamic Governance based on the sermons of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. We are presently discussing the third sermon called the Sermon of Sheikh Shiqiya, and Imam Ali alayhi salam explains the reasons behind taking over the government behind accepting to lead the Islamic government at that time. And as mentioned previously, that Imam Ali alayhi salam did not have any worldly intentions, because attachment to power was something very far from his existence. That was something very weak and small. Rather, the whole world and what was inside it was nothing valuable in his eyes, let alone the power that comes with it. And Imam Ali alayhi salam gives a beautiful example, or rather a very, you can say, strong example. And the example is that, just imagine, there are some goats in a herd of animals, and from those goats there is a sick goat who is suffering from a certain type of flu. And you know, when goats or animals suffer from flu, a lot of mucus is collected, and that mucus begins to flow over their mouths. Now you can imagine, this is a very gruesome, you know, thing. It's a dirty, or rather gruesome, and you can say a very indecent thing. Like when someone sees and imagines, it doesn't look good, and it brings a sense of a cringing feeling in the heart when you think about it. Imam Ali alayhi salam says the world and whatever is inside it is more valueless than that mucus from a sick goat.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, Imam Ali alayhi salam explains, what is this power for him? Is the power itself valuable? Does it carry value in him, for him? Does the power and the worldly fame and glory and position, is that important for him? No. He says this power and everything of the world is lesser to me, is worse to me, is more valueless to me than even the mucus of the sneezing of a goat. Okay, when he says, "Wal alfaytum dunyakum hadhihi azhada 'indi min 'atfati 'anzin," he says, this world of yours is more further from me, is something that I dislike even more than the sneezing of a goat, than the mucus of the sneeze of a goat. So you can imagine. So that shows that Imam Ali alayhi salam was not after these things. And even he practically in his life, he was not someone who wanted power and authority because of that. No, he had something else in mind. He didn't want power and authority for the sake of power and authority, for the sake of having that position. Like some people, unfortunately, like doing that. They like people to kiss their hands and to show respect to them and bow down their heads and, you know, all of that, and listen to them. There are some people, unfortunately, weak, and they are like that. But Imam Ali alayhi salam was beyond that, and he gives that example. And you can imagine that Imam Ali alayhi salam, despite having to face so many enemies, having to fight battles, okay, the battle of Siffin, the battle of Jamal, all of these battles he had to fight to maintain that authority. What was in that authority when he didn't want it in its sake, for its own sake? So what was that thing that was causing him to maintain it and even fight for it at certain times? The wars that Imam Ali alayhi salam fought when he came to power were very, very tiresome and long wars, sometimes lasting up to 4.5 years with a lot of damage. But yet Imam Ali alayhi salam was continuing to maintain that power. What was the reason? There must have been something important that Imam Ali alayhi salam was after, and the direction that he wanted to take was very serious, and that is why he was taking all of these steps.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
So now, the most important question that comes here is that, what was Imam Ali after? Why did he accept? And why did he do all it takes to defend this authority once it came to him? What was the reason? For all these years, he was quiet. He was not interfering. Yes, he was not interfering, but he was a very active citizen in the Muslim community, doing social work, helping people, you know, causing guidance and many things that he used to do at that time. Sometimes even he would give advice, even stop the rulers from doing something bad. When he would see that things are getting out of hand, he would come and help them, even to that degree. But he was not seen to take any form of leadership or authority in that government, in those governments. But now that he got this government, what made him accept it? If that time he was not accepting it, now why? And on top of that, why was he ready to defend it so much? These are questions that every truth seeker would ask. What was that thing? What was that reason? And Imam Ali alayhi salam in this sermon explains what are the reasons. Now, these reasons are very important. Why? Because it will make us realize that an Islamic government, when it comes to power, or an Islamic system, it explains to us what those basic elements are, the reasons that a person should seek an Islamic government. This makes it clear that Islamic Islamic governance is not based on power for the sake of power. It is not at all based on material benefits. There is something in it, something more lofty to seek. And that is exactly what Imam Ali alayhi salam is trying to tell us in this sermon. And he says that لَوْلَا حُضُورُ الْحَاضِرِ وَقِيَامُ الْحُجَّةِ بِوُجُودِ النَّاصِرِ and he explains the reasons. Inshallah, we will discuss very soon in the sessions to come regarding the reasons that Imam Ali alayhi salam had. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
وبالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد ممجد والفضل يمنى هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
President Biden is navigating a politically fraught path on climate change after last weekend's deadly tornadoes, stopping short on Monday, 13th of December, of directly blaming global warming for the disaster, but emphasizing the storm's extreme nature and ordering officials to get more definitive answers. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Washington Post journalist Sean Sullivan, Annie Linsky, and Scott Clement. The piece is titled, Biden Walks a Careful Line on Climate After Tornadoes. Stay with us for more. President Biden is navigating a politically fraught path on climate change after last weekend's deadly tornadoes, stopping short on Monday, 13th of December, of directly blaming global warming for the disaster, but emphasizing the storm's extreme nature and ordering officials to get more definitive answers. President Biden, facing an unusual series of violent weather events during his first year in office, has been forced to change the way presidents have long dealt with natural disasters. A task that once involved calling local leaders, offering aid, and consoling victims. All things that Joe Biden has done has expanded to far more politically sensitive terrain. Scientists are drawing clearer lines between global warming and destructive weather, often prompting Biden to warn of the urgent need to address rising temperatures. And some climate activists say the tornadoes underline the urgency of swift action. But Republicans are eager to pounce on any exaggeration of climate change's impact, putting pressure on Biden not to get ahead of what is verifiable. We have to be very careful. We can't say with absolute certainty that it was because of climate change, Joe Biden said on Monday, 13th of December, after officials briefed him on the tornadoes. But he added, "What is certain, it is one of the worst tornado disasters we've had in the country. And the second thing that's certain is that it is unusual. It is unusual how it happened, how many places it touched down, and the length of the path. So that's all I'm prepared to talk about right now." President Biden on Wednesday, 15th of December, plans to visit Kentucky, where tornadoes killed at least 74 people. At least 14 more were killed in other states. Kentucky leans heavily conservative and is the home of Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, a vocal critic of Joe Biden's climate agenda. Senator Mitch McConnell did not mention climate change in a floor speech on Monday on the tornadoes. President Biden said he has ordered the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, and other departments to delve more deeply into whether climate change is responsible for the tornadoes or contributed to their ferocity. Although the precise connection between climate change and tornadoes is not certain, experts have said that higher temperatures could intensify these violent storms. The recovery efforts come at a moment when climate change is at the center of Joe Biden's domestic agenda. He is trying to push a bill across the finish line on Capitol Hill that, among other things, would make historic investments in fighting climate change. His administration is also promoting a new infrastructure law that makes large investments in a vast network of electric vehicle charging stations. Meanwhile, Vice President Kamala Harris traveled to Maryland on Monday to focus attention on the administration's push to electrify the country's transportation system. "There can be no doubt the future of transportation in our nation and around the world is electric," Kamala Harris said. Without directly referring to the tornadoes over the weekend, Harris noted that a reason for the administration's urgency on climate is the extreme weather that is increasingly gripping the country, from wildfires to tornadoes to floods. Across our nation, rising sea levels are flooding streets, Harris said. Wildfires are burning out of control. Scientists and environmentalists describe climate change as an existential threat that could cause untold harm to humans and other species if far-reaching changes are not made fast. And Biden has made tackling this problem a centerpiece of his domestic and foreign policy blueprints. But Republicans are quick to criticize Biden's climate agenda as an overreaction to an exaggerated problem that will cost jobs and raise prices. Robert Stavins, director of Harvard University's Environmental Economics Program, said relying too heavily on extreme weather to make the case for climate mitigation can backfire, because opponents can point to stretches of fair or frigid weather to argue that action isn't needed. He recalled a Republican senator organizing activists to stand outside in Washington during a snowstorm with signs that read, "Honk if you think global warming is a hoax." One has to be very careful, in my opinion, of getting too far out in front of these claims, because it can come back to haunt you, Stavins said. For many years, presidents dealt with natural disasters as acts of God, spending little time litigating their causes and devoting most of their energy to dealing with the aftermath. But over the past decade, experts have been able to more definitively attribute the strength of the storms to changes in the climate, strengthening the hand of politicians who are urging policy changes, said Paul Bledsoe, who served as a climate advisor to the Clinton White House. "We didn't have that in the 1990s, when we were trying to warn the American public that this public safety crisis was coming," said Bledsoe, who is now a strategic advisor at the Progressive Policy Institute. Even during President Barack Obama's tenure, it was difficult to conclusively draw the connections between extreme weather events and warming temperatures, he said. Still, the science connecting tornadoes to climate change is limited, he said, which helps explain why Joe Biden has stopped short of attributing the recent tornadoes to the planet's warming. Nonetheless, a volatile issue has become part of the response to natural disasters, an area that had largely been free of politics. Biden in particular has sought to stress unity and empathy after such tragedies, but even his relatively limited statements on climate change in response to reporters' questions have drawn attacks from the right. On other occasions, Biden has been blunt, warning that the country faces a code red moment on climate. "We know that decades of forest management decisions have created hazardous conditions across the western forest, but we can't ignore the reality that these wildfires are being supercharged by climate change," he said in remarks after observing areas destroyed by wildfires earlier this year. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki stressed that many communities of all ideological stripes are affected by severe weather events fueled by climate change. But she signaled that Biden's visit on Wednesday would be more about providing comfort to those hit hardest by the recent tornadoes. "That visit is really about him receiving an update of the work that's happening on the ground, hearing directly from leaders on what they need more from the federal government, if anything," she said, adding, "He's not going to give a major speech while he's there." The president is also likely to stress the need to support the victims and their families. On Saturday, as news of the devastation was emerging, Joe Biden stressed the human cost to those who had lost their homes and worse. "My heart aches for those people right now, including the rescuers," he said. "Everything is gone from the baptismal photograph to the wedding picture to the picture of your oldest daughter in a ballet. It's profound. Politicians like Biden are becoming more vocal about extreme weather, just as the public is expressing more concern. A September opinion survey conducted by the nonpartisan Pew Research Center showed that 67% of the American public said extreme weather events are happening more often than in the past, including majorities across all major regions of the country. A 2019 opinion poll from the Washington Post and the Kaiser Family Foundation found that 63% of people who said their area had been affected by severe storms, droughts, or extreme hot days identified climate change as a major factor. Still wider acceptance of the impact of climate change does not necessarily mean that Americans will back mitigation efforts in large numbers. Many Republicans, elected officials, and even some Democrats have resisted aggressive efforts to curtail emissions, arguing that doing so comes at the expense of workers in industries involving fossil fuels. Revving up the country's battle against climate change after 4 years under President Donald Trump, when the battle was largely abandoned, has been a central theme of Joe Biden's presidency. The climate challenge is one of four major crises he pledged to tackle upon taking office, along with the coronavirus pandemic, the economy, and racial justice. In February, the United States officially rejoined the Paris Climate Accord, a major international agreement from which Donald Trump had withdrawn. Joe Biden also took a leading role at a recent international climate summit in Glasgow, Scotland. Beyond that, climate has been a pillar of Biden's two highest-profile legislative packages, the infrastructure law that recently took effect and a social programs bill that he hopes to push through in the coming weeks. "We all know everything is more intense when the climate is warming. Everything," Biden said on Saturday. He added, "And obviously it has some impact here, but I can't give you a quantitative read on that." Just listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 41 meters, 7300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Oh, Lord, hear so I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alamin. Wa sallallahu ala sayyidina wa nabiyyina wa maulana Abil Qasim al-Mustafa Muhammad wa ala ahli baytihi at-tayyibin at-tahirin al-ma'sumin. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners. Welcome to another episode of Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio. As we mentioned previously, faith, belief, is a matter that deals with the heart. It is something that cannot be seen except by manifestation, actions. Even our intentions which stem from this belief is not something that can be seen besides by the... Even by our actions, for example, those intentions cannot be seen at times. But they will manifest themselves. But as we mentioned, obviously the belief has different levels, has different, you know, classifications, and so on and so forth. And one of the means by increasing this belief and this faith is by doing good deeds and good actions. This is one of the means. Here we'll mention the second one, to have good thoughts and good intentions. It also benefits the faith and the belief of a person if he's continually thinking good stuff, having good intentions for others and for himself. But in this tradition from Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam, the strength of the believer is mentioned in terms of the believer himself, in the face of difficulties, in the face of hardships. That no matter what will come, what will hit him, the believer will not veer from his path, a true believer. The Imam alayhi salam is reported to have said that verily the believer is stronger than plates of iron or pieces of iron. Basically iron. That the believer is stronger than this. And the Imam mentions the reason why as well. For when a piece of iron enters the fire, it changes. When fire enters, when iron enters a furnace, obviously we know it melts and it can be shaped, it can be changed into a particular form. It can be played with, if you want to put it in, you know, blunt terms. It can be manipulated. You know, beautiful similes here that we can use. Where's the believer? May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala make us of these individuals, inshaAllah. Where's the believer were he to be killed for the sake of his religion, then resurrected, and then killed again for the sake of that religion, his heart would never change. We see clearly this type of narration mentioned where? On the day. Rather, on the night of Ashura. And the companions of Imam Hussein in unison was saying this. Why? Because they are certain. They are certain that this life in front of them doesn't have any meaning. That what is true is the hereafter, and that death is true. Whether you kill me now or you kill me tomorrow, I will leave this transient world. But that faith is something that will last, is that faith that will remain with me forever. And therefore it needs to be firm, it needs to be strong, it cannot be manipulated, it cannot be changed. Inshallah, until next time, my dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
This one leg. Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
According to New York Times and several other news outlets, Washington has decided against punishing any members of the U.S. military involved in an August drone attack.